Du lyssnar på MyPex. Hur blir ett land världsbäst på integration? Ett seminarium som Arena Idé arrangerade tillsammans med Röda Korset den 5 april. I den här delen av seminariet så hör du en föreläsning från Thomas Huddleston som är huvudforskare på MyPex. Moderator är Lisa Pelling, statsvetare och utredningschef för Arena Idé. Missa inte den andra delen av seminariet som innehåller kommentarer och en paneldiskussion med Andreas Beer, Patrick Joyce, Ida Holmgren och Christos Tamas. Du vet väl att du kan lyssna på andra seminarier som Arena Idé arrangerat. Gå in bara på Arena Play, antingen via SoundCloud, iTunes eller valfri podcast-app.
Hjärtligt välkomna hit! Vi tänkte att hälften av salen skulle vara tom på grund av det dåliga vädret. Men ni har trotsat kylan och regnet för att komma hit till vackra Ersta terrass. Tusen tack för det och för det engagemang, det personliga engagemang som ni alla visar i olika kapaciteter för att ni kommer hit. Jag heter Lisa Pelling och jag är utredningschef på tankesmedjan Arena Idé. Men vi gör det här seminariet som sagt tillsammans med Röda Korset. Det är vi väldigt stolta, lite malliga över. Jag vill redan nu tacka Ida Holmgren som är sakkunnig i migration- och integrationsfrågor på Röda Korset för det här jättefina samarbetet och för möjligheten att vara just i den här vackra salen. I think I'll switch to you then, Thomas. It's a great honor to have one of the key architects behind MyPex here in Sweden. You were about to come last summer and you had a problem with your flight and couldn't come. So we decided we'd try invite you again. And I think the issues that you've been working on, comparative integration studies, are more acutely important now than they were maybe last summer, not least because we are facing major reforms and major changes to the Swedish legislation, which will also have, we think, profound implications for the possibilities of integrating into Sweden as a newly arrived immigrant. So we've asked you, Thomas, to comment both upon why Sweden, over the years, again and again, is at the top of the MyPex, of this index comparing countries when it comes to integration policies, and what might happen with Sweden's position when these new legislation comes into effect, if it does come into effect indeed, because as you all know, the proposed changes to the foreign legislation in Sweden have been sent out for review, have been heavily criticized, and are not due to be decided in Parliament until June. So there is ample of time for those of you who work in government authorities or in NGOs or in other organizations to try influence the legislation that is proposed, and maybe that's what we're hoping. This seminar can inspire you, can give you some tools, can give you some knowledge that can be used to that effect. So Thomas Huddleston, you are a policy analyst at the Migration Policy Group. You call it a European think tank and do tank. And I think MyPex is one of the more concrete things you do. You have been involved, if I understood it correctly, for a few years now in several editions, but you're co-directing this latest issue that was published in 2015. So the numbers are very recent indeed. The Migration Policy Group, you write on your website, does not only work on migration and mobility, but you do connect this to equality. And you write, and I think this is beautifully phrased, these are intrinsically linked. You cannot think about mobility and migration without at the same time thinking about equality. And when you think about equality, you think of barriers to migration and mobility, such as discrimination on the labor market, such as discriminatory citizenship laws, all that comes into integration policies. So the Migration Policy Group works on both of these issues and put a special priority on international movement of person and on diversity and integration and in anti-discrimination and equality. I will hand over to you now, Thomas. You promised us you will look at Sweden's performance and also then at the end look into some specific aspects of Sweden's integration policy that might be affected now with the new proposed legislation. Please, the floor is yours.
All right, good morning, everyone. The reason why you see my face up here on the presentation is that I've been trying to speak a lot to actors in Sweden. I was recently speaking to the local and regional authorities via Skype, which is why my face was there. So they could not only get to know me, but get to know the MIPEX, because I think that comparing integration policies between Sweden and other countries is often very much misunderstood, because I think Sweden's integration policies are often misunderstood. And the efforts and effectiveness of Sweden's integration policies are also misunderstood. And while for many years it has been charming to see that Swedes are very humble and always want to improve, I have seen over the past years that this has meant that the public has not often understood what integration policies have achieved in Sweden, and particularly as a certain group in the population tries to win electoral votes on this issue. If we do not have a clear understanding that we can express to the public about what integration policies are trying to achieve, then actually we might undermine our achievements and end up creating long-term exclusion. So it was very important for me to come here and speak today. The question that I was asked to present was, how does a country become the best in the world at integration? So my first remarks are going to be to help you to understand what Sweden has already achieved. And then I will look in the future at what is the purpose of these new restrictions on family reunification and access to permanent residence. Is this really the norm in Europe? Does this comply with the standards that Sweden helped to create at the European level? And what do we know might be some of the effects? So there will be an optimistic side and maybe a more pessimistic side. So just so you understand what you receive from the MIPEX, we give you clear policy comparisons based on the legislation in practice. We're the most reliable and comprehensive index on integration policies. But we are also providing you better statistics that can help you to understand what is the need for integration policy in your country. And is your policy reaching the people that it's trying to reach? Is it associated with the kinds of outcomes that you want to see? And maybe are those policies driving those outcomes? And we've also looked to raise the bar even higher on integration policies, looking to see where have integration policies really been evaluated robustly so that we can show that policies have had a clear impact. Now, on the MIPEX website, which I'd like to briefly jump to, you can receive all of this information in full detail. You have, particularly I would recommend, our main publications, where we have the key findings, but we've also looked at the dynamics between integration policies and integration outcomes. We've looked at those evaluations to see what policies actually help improve labor market integration. And we've done an analysis of the very strong links between integration policies and public opinion. So my presentation will give you just some of the highlights of the study. As a reminder, it's a study that covers the developed world, the liberal democracies that are becoming countries of immigration. And we look at many key areas that are important for people's participation in society, where we look at whether the policies are aiming to promote equal rights and equal opportunities for immigrants. So the context that we are in, because I think Sweden is now being very much affected by the same context as other countries in Europe. So we have small numbers of families that are separated across Europe, from our estimates, somewhere between 4 to 7% of non-EU born citizens are in a relationship with a partner who doesn't live with them in their household. This particularly affects the most vulnerable groups. Yeah, so people who are very young or very old, the low educated, those from war-torn situations. Now, in the past years, we have, of course, a big increase in people coming for humanitarian reasons. Overall numbers of immigration in Europe have decreased since the crisis because we have fewer people who've been able to come for labor migration. And while we focus a lot on newcomers, we do have to look less at the numbers and more at the trajectory of these people. And I think it's important to remember that most of the non-EU citizens who are in a country like Sweden or are in Europe actually are here long-term. They have people who've already lived here 5 or more years. And many of the people who are coming nowadays are relatively likely to settle long-term because they're fleeing protracted conflicts. So we should remember that actually the people who are coming here are probably unlikely to be temporary. There is a great need for integration policies across Europe. Sweden is not exempt from this. About a third of non-EU citizens who are in Europe are not in employment, education, and training. Very few of them are able to access the adult education system in the country that they live in. Very few of them end up getting a new degree in the country that they live in. And actually, there are large numbers of unemployed immigrants who are not accessing unemployment benefits or accessing other benefits that people normally use in our societies to become socially integrated. Another challenge, I would say, is related to social mixing. So in general in Europe, we have a problem of the over-concentration of immigrant children in disadvantaged schools. And they're much more likely to be in these disadvantaged schools than non-immigrant children who have low-educated parents. So even when you compare like with like, immigrant children are more likely to be concentrated in these underperforming schools. And we know that this has a disadvantage on their educational outcomes. Immigrants are also more likely to be concentrated in disadvantaged areas. I can say, coming from the United States, that we have nothing like ghettos in Europe. Luckily, this has been showed from research. But it is important to know that even if the phenomenon is not as problematic here on the continent, this still can block people from accessing social opportunities, employment opportunities. And a lot of our anti-discrimination laws in Europe are very young, not so strong, and in general, victims of racial, ethnic, and religious discrimination don't report their cases when they experience discrimination to public authorities because they think nothing's going to happen. So this is common across Europe. This is not unique to Sweden. Now, I think that Sweden is actually better positioned to confront these challenges that we see in Europe. Why? Sweden is a long-standing country of immigration. You actually have some of the greatest experience with many of the issues that are key today. You still are not there, yeah? Learning Swedish, fighting discrimination, working through the public employment service, but you actually have a lot more experience that you can call upon and many people who are trained to deal with these issues. And you have a general socioeconomic context which is more favorable for integration than in other countries. Now, I know, again, that you are focusing in on your national context and you're worried about the increase of inequality in Sweden, but generally, inequality levels in Sweden are much lower than in other developed countries. You also have some of the highest employment rates overall for the general public. You also have many of the education, employment, and social policies that have been proven effective in evaluations of general policies. And you have some of the most positive public attitudes towards immigration and diversity across many different measures. So I was then not surprised that there was a political and public consensus about maintaining Sweden's investment in integration. But we know that this can be extremely fragile, particularly when people start losing perspective. Now, as you know, MIPEX says that Sweden ranks number one on its integration policies. It means that its policies are aiming the most in most areas towards equal rights and opportunities in the laws and policies that are developed by government. But as we're getting more statistics and more evaluations, I can say much more. I would say that not only is Sweden one of the most ambitious countries in its integration policies, but it's one of the most responsive. So as these needs for integration policies are identified, as people who we become clear that there is inequality in the labor market, in the education system, with barriers to accessing family unification and discrimination, generally Sweden has tried to address those barriers and identified them and raise awareness of the need to do that. That's common generally here in the Nordic countries, whereas I can tell you on the continent, many people just turn a blind eye to the diversity in their society. You're also one of the countries that is most evidence-based, in the sense that there are very few countries that are actually doing evaluations of their integration policies. Robust causal evaluations that allow us to see what's been the impact. And you are one of the few that does pilots, does experiments, and if these pilots find that something is not working, I'm thinking of the language bonus that was offered, you actually discontinue it. I don't know of any country in, on the continent where when they would do an evaluation and then a policy would prove to be not very effective, that the government would be willing to admit this in public and make a change. As I said, you have policies that are some of the best supported by the general context. You have a favorable economic, social, and until perhaps recently, political context for making sure that all services are actually working on integration. And as you'll see from some of the statistics I'm going to present to you, I think that you're one of the most effective in your integration policies because your policies reach more of the residents who are in need than most countries do. We see in some areas that you actually are having a clear positive effect on people's outcomes in different areas of society. And in other areas which are new, harder to understand, you are investing in and evaluating policies that from other evaluations we see tend to be most effective for promoting integration outcomes. Now, I think one of the most worrying dynamics, it's always happened for Sweden, is that you are also one of the most closely watched integration policies. Inaction in other countries then sometimes has to be explained by what Sweden is doing. Well, we're not doing this because we don't want to be like Sweden, or we can't do this because we are not Sweden. Or, Sweden, they say that they have problems, so actually we shouldn't do anything. And I think this has created a very unhealthy dynamic for you and also for your government, that they have to actually be the ones giving a very clear understanding of what's going on in their country. But I do think that you are trendsetting. People are watching what's going on in Sweden and are often willing to follow. So overall, people often focus on the overall MIPEX result, as I said, which looks at the policies. And as you see, generally the countries that are most inclusive of immigrants by guaranteeing equal rights and opportunities in their policies and legislation are the countries of Northern Europe and the traditional countries of immigration, as well as newcomers, Spain and Portugal. Labor market mobility. We then look at whether the targeted policies on labor market integration are trying to guarantee equal rights for newcomers and also to address their specific needs as foreign-trained people who sometimes are missing specific skills for the country. Now, here I'm not going to talk about the policies, but I'm going to talk about the effectiveness. And I think that when you look in international comparison, what it's important to remember is that labor market integration happens over time. It depends on many factors, the policies, the general policies, the conditions in the labor market, but it improves over time. And I think we must remember this, because too often we focus on the aggregate statistics, the situation of the person who's been there for 1 year, and we're punishing people who are just at the start of the process, while forgetting that they're actually in a process which shows improvements over time. So I'd like to show you a new set of analysis that we have done with the European Labour Force Survey, which is the most comprehensive European survey on immigrant integration. And it has just been published for 2014. And I think that you will find some of the results quite interesting when you start to look at integration as a process. So here you see the employment rates for the foreign-born, who are working age, who've been there for 1 to 5 years, in blue, the newcomers, and those who've been there for more than 10 years. So what you see, as I say, is that when you compare cohorts, it's not exactly a comparison over time, but that those who are long settled in a country have much higher employment rates than newcomers do. And if you would look for that for Sweden, you would get around an employment rate of around 74%. And when you look across countries, actually, the employment rates for the long settled are some of the highest in Sweden among European countries. Now, we've also broken this down to look at those who've been there for 10 years by their reason for migration. So we're looking at, for example, in green, the employment rates for those who come as family members, or in purple, the employment rate for those who come with international protection. And again, what you might notice in Sweden is that the employment rates for long-settled family migrants and refugees is not that different from the average, so around 75%. And what might be hard to read in this graph is actually that the employment rates for family migrants and for refugees who are long-settled in Sweden are higher than in most other European countries. We also have looked to see what are the employment rates for people of different education levels. So here, I'm looking at people foreign-born, not just long-settled, but all foreign-born, and I'm comparing what are the employment rates of the low-educated who are non-immigrants, who are first-generation, who are second-generation. So comparing like with like. And what you can see here for Sweden is that by the second generation, even for the low-educated, there are not that many differences in employment rates between low-educated non-immigrants in Sweden and low-educated second-generation in Sweden. And what's perhaps more important to remember is that the low-educated are much more likely to be employed in a country like Sweden than they are in most other European countries. Employment rates for the low-educated are higher in Sweden than in most other European countries. And the same is true for people with a university degree, where you can see that by the second generation, there are actually no differences in employment rates for non-immigrants and second generation who have a tertiary education degree, and that actually employment rates for the highly educated are highest in Sweden than in most other European countries. So again, perhaps when you have some international perspective, it becomes clear that there are many achievements that have been made in Sweden's integration policies. So that's my point on effectiveness. But as I said also, Sweden's policies are reaching many of those who are in need. So for example, this is a statistic on the foreign-born working age and asking whether they had taken a language course in their country. This also comes from the 2014 EU Labour Force Survey. And what you see circled here in yellow are the percent of foreign-born working age who have attended a language course. And what you can see here are the countries where over half of the foreign-born have participated in a language course. And what you see is that in Sweden, in Finland, in Norway, you are reaching more people with your language courses than most countries do. Where you can even see in many countries in orange, that there are large numbers of people who don't participate in language courses, and it's not because they say it's not necessary for them. There are other obstacles that mean that they can't participate in language courses. And lastly, as I said, most non-EU citizens are not able to access the adult education system in their countries. Very few of them end up getting a degree. Whereas in Sweden, we see that non-EU citizens are the most likely in Europe to access some form of lifelong learning, and that's true for men and for women. For women, as you see, almost half. And these numbers of those who are participating in lifelong learning have increased quite substantially since 2008. So perhaps it's related to the labor market introduction reform, having tried to open up adult education for non-EU citizens. So I think that, as I said, Sweden is reaching more people in need. We also see from evaluations that Sweden has been trying to invest in the often costly but cost-effective programs that promote labor market integration. So language courses for your job or at work, startup benefits for migrant entrepreneurs, bridging programs that try and help skilled newcomers to get the specific qualifications that they need for their particular sector. Of course, the challenge is to expand access to these types of programs and to increase the investment in these programs because we know that they help people to get into work. Sweden also comes out as number one on our index with regard to anti-discrimination laws. So like other countries, like the traditional countries of immigration, the United Kingdom, Sweden has a relatively strong set of anti-discrimination laws, policies, duties. But as I said, we have to remember that we're only at the start of working on these issues. In general, in Europe, people who say that last year they experienced racial, religious, or ethnic discrimination often say in surveys they haven't reported it because they don't think anything's going to change from it. So it is an overall challenge. But we were then interested to calculate, well, actually, how many people who last year said that they were the victim of racial, religious, or ethnic discrimination might have made a complaint. So we took survey data on people saying that they were a victim of discrimination, and we looked at the number of complaints that were made to the equality bodies in different countries. And that's what you see in the chart on the left, whereas you can see in many European countries there are hardly any complaints. Like in Latvia, there's one complaint submitted for every 25,000 people who say that they felt like they were the victim of some form of racial, ethnic, or religious discrimination. And you can see that the countries that are making the greatest effort, that are trying to reach out the most, are countries like Sweden, the Netherlands, France, where still we only see about one complaint to an equality body for perhaps every 200 people who say that they were the victim of discrimination. But I think that by continuing to invest in informing people of their rights and creating stronger legislation, we will end up making a dent in the fight against discrimination. We see from extra research that's been done of MIPEX that countries that have strong anti-discrimination laws and policies end up having a general public that is more informed of their rights as victims of discrimination, and that then the public is more likely to report that they've witnessed discrimination. And some research suggests that in the countries that have strong anti-discrimination laws, immigrants have greater trust in the justice system. So there's still work to be done here, but Sweden has been making quite an effort. Also, when we look in the education system for children, we see that Sweden, like other Nordic countries and the traditional countries of immigration, has tried to support schools and teachers to respond to the diverse needs of their pupils. And we also see that these countries seem to be reaching many of these children. So in the map, you see the share of first-generation pupils who have low literacy on PISA. And we look to see, well, what percent of them are actually getting any kind of remedial language courses? And so what you see in the darker colors are where the vast majority of low-literacy first-generation pupils are getting extra support. And so as you can see, in the Nordic countries and in traditional countries of immigration, this extra support, you can say, seems to be reaching many pupils in need. And we see progress from the first to the second generation in terms of educational outcomes. This graph here is a bit more complicated to read, but what we did here is we compared non-immigrant children who have a low-educated mother to second-generation children who have a low-educated mother. The reason being that the education of your parents is actually the major determining factor behind your own educational outcomes. And so we're interested to see, well, when you compare non-immigrant and second-generation children with low-educated mothers, what are their outcomes? And so we looked at the low achievers rate from PISA, so it's the number of children who don't get basic math skills. And what you see is that by the second generation in Sweden, second generation pupils with low educated mothers are just as likely to be low math achievers as non-immigrant children with low educated mothers. And the same is true in a number of other countries that I circle here, such as the traditional countries of immigration. Now, in the education system, as I said, there's still work to be done, and everyone knows this. It's very difficult to affect what goes on in classrooms and to support school leaders and teachers to change their approach to immigrant children, and there's quite a large consensus if you look at what the EU says or what international experts say about supporting migrant education. But I think one weakness we see across Europe is a lack of school mixing. So the over-concentration of immigrant children in disadvantaged schools. This data comes from the OECD's PISA study. And in purple, you see what's the difference in the math PISA score for first and second generation compared to non-immigrants, right? So overall, in many of our countries, children with an immigrant background get lower PISA scores. But then the OECD has started to control for some of those factors that we think are driving the lower achievement. And what you see is that, yes, the language that's spoken at home is a factor that drives it. Country of birth, to a certain extent, drives the differences, depending on the level of development of the country of origin and the education system. But you can see one of the major drivers is the level of social and economic status of the school. So if you're going to a school that's a favored school, and you're of an immigrant background, even with all of these factors, you will do much better. And this is a weakness that we have across Europe that I think requires much more attention. I'm going to come back to family reunification. But what I wanted to point out here, at least to inform you now, is that yes, also Sweden has come out on MIPEX as having one of the most inclusive family reunification policies, and that it has an effect on the family reunification rate, meaning that non-EU citizens are more likely to reunite with their families in a country like Sweden than in many other European countries. And generally, we found that that's also true for disadvantaged groups. The countries that have more inclusive policies also tend to have women-headed households or families that come from different nationalities, including refugee families, more likely to reunite in those types of countries. And also, Sweden has had a clear path to permanent residence. So here, you see what percent of non-EU citizens who've been in the country for 5 years have a permanent residence permit. It's an estimation on our part. So what you see is that in Sweden, by the time you've been there for 5 years, I mean, almost 100% of the non-EU citizens in Sweden have a permanent residence permit. And that's true as in the United Kingdom, to a certain extent true as in a country like France. But you see that there are many other European countries where even those people who've been there for 5 or more years and thus should be entitled to long-term residence are still on a temporary status. And a lot of this is driven by the legislation that involves delays, involves exclusions of particular permit categories, conditions that people cannot meet, and that then keeps those who are, as I say, going to be settled long-term from enjoying the equal rights and the stable residence that would allow them to participate more extensively in public life. And I'll come back to this as we discuss the future in Sweden. When we look at political participation and naturalization citizenship policies, Sweden has also been, like many other Nordic countries, an example of an inclusive Nordic democracy, where we see that those who are settled long-term are very likely to become citizens, are very likely to be eligible to vote, and often to be participating in some way in public life. Now, we all know that first generation are less likely to participate politically than, just say, the general public. But again, this improves over time and depends on many factors. One of which is, generally, how active is your democracy? And Sweden has a very active democracy. And when you compare, then, how much immigrants participate in Sweden to how much immigrants participate in other countries, you see that actually immigrants are more likely to be participating in a country like Sweden than in other European countries. So here you see what percent of non-EU-born adults who've been there for 10 or more years are in some way participating in public life. We came up with an index here. And compared to adults who were born in the country. So as I said, yes, there is a gap between long-settled non-EU immigrants and native-born adults. But I've ranked this in terms of the level of participation of non-EU immigrants across Europe, and you see that immigrants are much more likely to participate in a country like Sweden or Norway, Ireland, Belgium, the United Kingdom, than in countries like the Netherlands, Austria, Germany, or in Central or Southern Europe. And when we look at more issues of legal status, you can also see that immigrants are given more opportunities to participate in public life in a country like Sweden. Here I show you in pink the percent of non-EU citizens who are eligible to vote in local elections, so the enfranchisement. And not surprisingly, most non-EU citizens who are long settled in a country like Sweden are eligible to vote at the local level. And in red, I show you the percent of non-EU citizens who've been there for 10 or more years who have become citizens. So they've been there already for 10 or more years. Under the legislation, they should all be eligible for citizenship if the policy and procedure are not too complicated. And so in a country like Sweden, as you see, you have the vast majority of non-EU long-settled immigrants who become citizens, as in countries like the Netherlands or France or a few Central European countries. And here I want to talk a little bit more about the effects, because I'm not going to come back to the issues of naturalization and political participation. But we have to remember that these types of issues have effects on integration in various areas of public life. So research from other European countries suggests that those who are most integrated are most likely to naturalize, and actually, perhaps, that the actual process of naturalization and the rights that, and the perception that you receive afterwards helps to boost the labor market integration of certain groups of immigrants. Research also suggests that becoming a citizen makes you more likely to report discrimination. And other research suggests that those who naturalize end up having easier times in various areas of social life. So overall, as I said, if I look at some of our key indicators of the effectiveness of integration policy, so if I look at the participation in extra literacy courses for children, in adult education, if I look at the general level of public awareness on discrimination rights and the degree to which victims of racial, religious, and ethnic discrimination are making complaints to equality bodies, if I look at whether non-EU citizens are given the stable resident status and equal rights to participate, to vote, and to become citizens, Sweden outscores every other European country as being one that, as I say, is reaching more immigrants than most. Now, as I said in my introduction, I think that Sweden's very high bar for success is a blessing for integration in practice, but is sometimes a curse for the public debate. Because you constantly want to achieve greater equality, you want to achieve greater outcomes in all areas of society, you are never sufficient. And so this lack of contentment is then what is expressed in the public sphere by everyone. Everyone is talking about the problems that exist on integration, the need to continue to work on integration, without remembering that many people in the public are not really that interested in discussing immigration or integration. They have a limited tolerance for these types of discussion, and that there are certain political parties that make their business on actually talking about integration problems. As an example, when I was in Norway, and I talked about how in Norway many immigrants are likely to participate politically, a member of the Norwegian government then responded, "Well, yes, I know you say we're doing things on immigrant political participation, but we know that immigrants are underrepresented at the level of the leadership of political parties and in boards of companies." And I said, "Absolutely. The same is true for women. And you are at the top of the class at trying to promote equality. But you have to talk about what you have achieved. Because if you don't talk about what you have achieved, then all the public hears about is problems, 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 and at some point, their tolerance will be over." This is very worrying because from analysis of MIPEX, we see that integration policies are very highly correlated to public opinion. And this is probably one of the most astonishing results from this last round. There have been 20 studies that compare MIPEX to public opinion results, and they all find that generally what you think about immigrants says more about you than it does about immigrants, right? We know this, that individual factors determine public attitudes towards immigration. But that there are very few other things about your country that determine whether what you think about immigrants, right? It's not as if people who live in countries with more immigrants or with better integration outcomes or with a better employment situation are more favorable to immigrants. The one country-level factor that matters for your views on immigrants is the integration policy. So countries that have inclusive integration policies as measured by MIPEX have publics that are much more accepting of immigrants. They think that they should have equal rights. They think that their places, their city is a good place for immigrants to live. And they see immigrants as opportunities. Whereas the countries that have the most restrictive integration policies are the countries where the public thinks of immigrants not as an opportunity but as a threat, and thinks that their rights need to be restricted and regulated. Now, research doesn't tell us which is driving what. I think it's a bit of both. But from my own experience of public debates, I think that the public is relatively uninformed about who immigrants are, how many there are, what is the situation in their own country, and that their attitudes can be very strongly influenced by the public debate and by politicians. And I also then think that once immigration policy becomes politicized, once it becomes a game in politics, then it becomes a big political responsibility for political actors to explain to the public what their integration policies are about, and not in abstract terms, but to explain why adult education is important for integration, why family unification is important for integration, why citizenship is important for integration. Because if not, at some point then, public opinion will change and there will be political opportunities then for the restriction and disinvestment from integration. So while I think that there are many things here which I mentioned that I think where Sweden could improve, and if the political consensus had remained, I would talk about those issues. Instead, I have to talk about this new proposal and what it might mean for integration in Sweden. If I can go on and finish with these points. So, I was asked to look at the restrictions that have been put in place on family reunification and the restriction on the residence permits for refugees and for beneficiaries of subsidiary protection. As I noted before, Sweden was one of those countries where immigrants of various types were much more likely to be able to reunite with their family members than other European countries, and much more likely to become permanent residents even before the 5 years, obviously, because beneficiaries of international protection enjoyed this facilitated access to a permanent residence permit. All I can say now is to maybe compare what Sweden is doing on family unification and permanent residence to what other countries are doing. If you had asked me in November, I would have given you a very different picture than today. There has been a mad rush in Northern Europe to restrict family reunification and permanent residence consistently in all countries. The justifications that are given are relatively similar and surprising. One is the race to the bottom. We don't want to be more generous than our neighbors. And the second is we can't handle all of these family migrants, or we can't handle them in terms of the infrastructure, or we can't handle them politically. We can't handle the discussion. These are very surprising explanations, very clear, because those justifications go against European law. There's the EU Family Reunification Directive, which set the minimum requirements across Europe, But explicitly, that directive says the purpose of family reunification is to promote integration, to give people the social, cultural stability that they need to actually invest in their integration. And the European Court of Justice has come down in a few cases already where countries have made restrictions to family reunification, disguised with other justifications, that this will promote integration, that this is a cost for the public. And they've said very clearly the point of this legislation cannot be to reduce the number of family reunifications. So the fact that legislation in Sweden, in Finland, in Germany is actually tied to the desire to restrict family reunification is already against European legislation and can be challenged in the European Court of Justice. So I find that surprising. I also find the argumentation a bit dubious. Why is that? Well, I don't think that making these restrictions is going to stop all of these people from trying to find some way to come together as a family. As you might know, on the Greek islands, the majority of people who've been showing up have been Syrians and mostly then men and women. We don't know if those people would have been eligible for family reunification, but many of them say that they have family in Germany. And German NGOs that are working on these issues note that, first of all, the procedures for family reunification in Germany are rather complicated. Even being able to access the German embassy in Turkey is quite complicated. Documentation is complicated. And the announcement that the German government was going to be restricting family reunification has had an effect in the refugee community as people try to quickly struggle to find some way, any way, that their families can come. So I have a concern that this kind of legislation that's removing legal channels at the moment that we need them is actually going to end up creating more irregular migration to Europe. So that's my first concern. My second concern is that no country says that they want to be attractive. A country like Sweden, or most of our countries, are attractive for many reasons. They are peaceful societies, they are inclusive societies. Stopping people from being able to reunite with their family members, I don't think, is going to dissuade them to go to one country or another, particularly as now almost every country is adopting these types of restrictions. So then in the end, Sweden is not necessarily a more or less attractive place to go. And then the other justification I've seen in the legislation is that this is adopting the minimum that is allowed by European legislation, the minimum that's done by most other countries. I have to say that when I read the proposal, many of these things are not done by other European countries. So, as I said, last year, if you had asked me what's the situation, I would tell you, well, in Europe, generally, refugees and beneficiaries of subsidiary protection, they have the same rights to family reunification. There are very few countries that offer less of a right to beneficiaries of subsidiary protection. I tried to find out which countries give no right to family reunification for subsidiary protection. The only ones I could find are Malta and Cyprus, two islands that are very restrictive in their immigration policies and arguably run guest worker policies, where refugees are not only not welcome, but are actively encouraged to leave the islands. So I couldn't find any other cases where there's no rights to family reunification for beneficiaries of subsidiary protection. Instead, there are other countries that are delaying the right to family reunification by 2 or 3 years. So Denmark, 3 years. Norway and Finland are still discussing the legislation, 2 years. Germany, Austria, 2 years. Though this was, again, not the norm, and many other European countries don't have this norm. The 3 month three-month period in which you can have a favorable conditions for family reunification is, to be true, is relatively the norm in many countries. It's what many European countries do require. However, what you hear from practitioners in those countries is that that actually might create more problems for family reunification. Because what that means is that in those first 3 months after you're recognized, you have to have a legal address. You have to find your family. You have to be able to submit the application, often from a third country. And if you run out of that, and that clock is constantly ticking. So it doesn't necessarily achieve a faster family reunification. It perhaps just sets up unrealistic expectations for refugee families. And then on permanent residence, indeed, Sweden was one of the few countries that would offer this facilitated access to permanent residence, though there are a number of countries that go give longer permits than what is now proposed in Sweden, particularly for beneficiaries of subsidiary protection. And I was just surprised at this trend of creating more temporary permits at a time when our bureaucracies are overstretched by the number of applications they have to handle for asylum and for family reunification. In contrast, France, a country well known for its bureaucracy, has moved from having annual permits to having a one-year permit followed by a three-year permit, then leading to permanent residence. And the argument was efficiency, that there was no reason to give temporary permits to people here who are going to stay long term. The government reported that 99% of renewals were accorded. And so based on the fact that renewal was no longer necessary, they tried to find a way around it. So these are the, let's say, the comparison between where Sweden is going and where other countries are going. I forgot to mention one other change which I found very surprising, that spouses and partners would have to be 21 before they could reunite. A minority of countries require this. When they do, they argue that it's better to fight forced marriages for this purpose, or that it might promote integration. This is a rather dubious argument, and the European Court of Justice has paid a lot of attention to this argument. But in this case, the justification is to shave off a few applications, I guess. So this would clearly go against European legislation. I also wanted to add, for those of you who are interested, that the EU Family Reunification Directive does set some minimum standards, and the government has clearly looked at those minimum standards to try and comply with them. However, you should also remember that Sweden is a signatory to the European Social Charter of the Council of Europe. And this social charter has a collective complaints mechanism. And the European Social Charter, under Article 19, notes that states have to facilitate family reunification in a rapid manner. And the jurisprudence of the Committee for Social Rights of the Council of Europe has been quite developed, noting that you cannot have long delays for family reunification, that the requirements cannot create extra burdens. And so some of these restrictions, particularly the restrictions for beneficiaries of subsidiary protection, might go against the European Social Charter. And then, of course, we cannot forget the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, which also notes that states have to expedite family reunification in a speedy manner as the separation of children goes against the best interest of the child. I hope that we don't have to come to this point where we only have to rely on what we promised to actually do what's better for integration. However, if that's what has to happen, then I imagine that Swedish courts will intervene. What I wanted to note is the potential negative effects for integration. Now, these are areas which are understudied in the research, so there's not that much that we can say.
Can I, Thomas, just to clarify, I'll give you a few more minutes.
Yeah,
I think
minutes,
you have patience with Thomas just mentioning the consequences. For those of you who maybe have not been able to study the proposed law in detail, I just wanted to remind you that what is proposed by the government at the moment is a three-year temporary law. And under this three-year temporary law, there are no permanent residence permits. Everyone who applies for asylum and is granted protection in Sweden will get a temporary permit. The only exceptions are quota refugees, those that are taken directly from refugee camps under the auspices of the UNHCR. And these are 2,000 people a year. So everyone else, temporary permits. One third, those that are convention refugees that get protection in Sweden according to the Geneva Convention, they will get 3-year permits, so 3-year temporary permits. There are around a third of those that are granted protection. Two thirds are those that are subsidiary protection, alternativt skyddsbehövande is the Swedish term. They will get 1-year permit, so 12 months of residence permit that then has to be renewed in a new application procedure. And I think this also stands out in European comparison, because in many other countries where you have a temporary permit, the temporary permit is prolonged if nothing happens. But here you'd have to go back to the migration board and have your entire application renewed and reviewed and renewed again before you can get. So this is an important. And then on family reunification, what happens is that people that get protection in Sweden according to the Geneva Convention, the convention refugees, they will have access to family reunification within 3 months. But if they are not able to hand in a full application, and this, as you said, sometimes entails moving your family out of Somalia, getting to the closest Swedish embassy, handing in a full application with all the documents, if you cannot manage in 3 months, you have to fulfill a very strict requirement of försörjningskrav, which is of supporting your family, which entails not only supporting yourself, but having an income that is enough to support your entire family. If you can't, you will not be able to reunite with your family. And this is for one third. For the two thirds who are alternativt skyddsbehövande, there is no right to family reunification at all, which, as Thomas says, is really stands out in European comparison, and it's questionable if it at all is legal according to European standards. Yeah. Sorry for interrupting.
No. I imagined that everyone in the room was already aware of this, and that I was the only one who was perhaps
I just
shocked.
To mention Michael Williams, who's here, has made a very nice summary of the proposed legislation that you can read in the latest issue of Article 14, which is the paper of the Swedish refugee movement. I think it's accessible also online, FARS hemsida, so if you want to have a look.
So yeah, just to conclude, the impact of these restrictions, we might be able to guess what the effect will be. I assume that the government is actually studying what will be the effect on integration. But there are some international studies that can allow us to maybe anticipate the potential effect. So what I can say from the MIPEX, this obviously, but we maybe all know this, will clearly have an effect on the family reunification rates of non-EU citizens, particularly those who are most vulnerable. Yeah, so women-headed families, very young or very elderly families, of course, people then in actual protracted conflict situations. And it will decrease the permanent residence rate as well. But this we can understand. But what will be the other effects on integration? Well, for family reunification, there is a lot of research that's been done on the basis of the PISA study of education outcomes of children. And here the OECD has said repeatedly that it's better for children to come as young as possible to a new country. So based on this, they have recommended rapid family reunification when a minor child is involved, because you will see that delaying family reunification where a child is involved will have a year-by-year cumulative effect on the child's chances to succeed in school in their country of new home country. So, for example, this graph shows you comparing the education scores on, I think it's on math, for children who arrived before the age of 5, so before compulsory school education, between the ages of 6 and 11 and 12 or older. What the OECD has found is that children who arrive before compulsory age often can catch up, and the outcomes are not different for them as for non-immigrant children. So that's why they use the zero as a benchmark. What you see is that in a country like Sweden in particular, there's a very large late arrival penalty. So if you arrive in Sweden after the age of 12, it's much more likely that you're not going to be able to catch up in the education system. But if you arrive between the ages of 6 and 11, as you see that little yellow bar, there's often no real difference between you and someone who already arrived before compulsory age. So based on this, you would want children to arrive as soon as possible, as young as possible. And based on these types of results, you could also imagine that the same would be true for adults, because the presumption is the younger that you are, the more flexible that you are to adjust to life in a new country, the more you're willing to and able to learn a new language, to re-educate if you need to get a new degree, replan your life. The older you are, the more that you are set in your career and in your life plans. So I think that these types of results also raise a warning bell that these kind of delays for family reunification might also keep many spouses behind, trailing behind their potential sponsor, creating inequalities in couples. In terms of permanent residence, there's not that much research, but there's been a great piece done with the MIPEX data by a young researcher named Owen Corrigan, where he looked to see what's the impact of permanent residence and citizenship on getting into a good, stable job. And what he found looking across Western Europe are that the countries that restrict permanent residence and citizenship end up having more immigrants stuck in low-quality, precarious work, whereas the countries that facilitate accessing, obtaining this permanent residence security end up having immigrants progressing on to more stable jobs. And this ties into the economics literature on the benefits of things like citizenship, where economists are saying, well, actually, when you have not only this stable residence permit, it not only gives you more stable equal rights, but it also changes the way that you're perceived by employers and by the public. You're going to stay long-term, so it makes sense for an employer to hire you, to invest in in-work training for you, and to give you a better job. So I would hope that the government will study this more in depth. I know that in Sweden you have really great data, also longitudinal data on permits and such, so I hope that there are Swedish researchers who can also help to clarify what might be the effect of delaying family reunification or delaying access to a permanent residence permit for long-term integration. We here at the Migration Policy Group are willing to help to better understand before Sweden takes this big step into the unknown. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Thomas. Thank you.